So I'll count it off. One, two, three, go. I'm in.
Tom Chick. You are listening to the 2:45 movie podcast, where this week we will be spoiling for people night and day. And this is not the short before Toy Story 3. This is the Tom Cruise Cameron Diaz movie. We have seen it. If you have not seen it, you may not want to listen. If you don't care about seeing it, I guess you can listen. We are going to be talking plot points. I am joined by Christian, I figured out how to pronounce it. Christian Muriziki.
Please stop saying my name. You keep saying my name, and it's freaking me out.
Racist.
I also have Kelly Wand. Kelly Wand, do you have a night and day themed tagline for us this week?
Yeah, it's an awesome one, and then it jumps the shark right after this. This is like the one good part.
Okay.
Parting, they seem to tread upon the air, twin roses by the zephyr blown apart, only to meet again more close.
Wow, that's a little long for a tagline. I don't know if it'll fit on the poster, but I like it.
Oh, wait, that's my synopsis. I'm sorry.
Do you have a synopsis for us? I think this movie would lend itself pretty well to synopses. Can you tell us what happens in Night and Day?
All right. I missed a key plot point. We'll get to that. But as best I can figure, Ashton Kutcher, I mean Angelina Jolie, I mean L. Tom Cruzzard, gets on a plane in Wichita with Cameron Diaz because he knows everyone who works for that airline is going to try and kill him. But he flirts with Cameron Diaz in the terminal, and they hit it off, so he decides to embroil her in this deadly scenario. So he kills everybody on the plane and mixes a couple drinks for the exact amount of time she's talking to herself in the bathroom and adjusting her boobs. And then they crash land in a cornfield, and he drugs her, and she wakes up in Boston somehow. I guess a different flight. And he made her an omelet and left her all these Post-its, one of which says, "Under this frying pan lid is an omelet." Anyway, Boston looks like San Francisco, and she's there for her sister's wedding, Maggie Grace, for Purgatory. But she has lunch with a fireman who's been pining for her for years. But then Tom Cruise shows up in the restaurant and takes her hostage and shoots the guy in the leg, which helps him get over her permanently. And then they get chased to his private island and shot at by drones and onto a train and through a bullfight because he has this magic battery that only blows up the second the villain gets it. And she realizes they're in love because he keeps drugging her and dragging her through all these intercontinental fights. And he can ring the lottery and publish his clearinghouse. So she drugs him back, and they go to Cape Horn and anonymously mail his parents plane tickets to Cape Horn since the CIA doesn't have their house wiretapped. And his bullet wound healed while she smuggled him out of the country unconscious.
Good. That was literally to the very end there. Although I didn't stay after the credits, so if there was like if they find Thor's hammer or something, I missed that part.
I thought the Easter egg was they mail the tickets to the parents who aren't even on screen because that would have been too expensive.
Well, it was sort of like they were reluctant to save that until after the credits. They figured people might get up and leave, so we're going to put the Easter egg before the credits to make
right.
sure people see it. They didn't have enough faith in people wanting to sit through the credits, I think.
It was an Ash Wednesday egg.
All right, well done. Okay.
Night and Day. That's the name of the movie, even though her name is June Havens, and it should be called Night Havens.
I have to say, this is a horrible title for a movie. How on earth?
Terrible title.
Well, it would be a great title if it meant something. If it related to the movie, it would be a cool title. Like, now, it was a chess
movie. Her name is Night, and her name is Havens. What's the title? Come on.
I will say one person. So since Dingus, you do a good job with this, I've started paying closer attention to what my audience says. And there was a woman behind me who, when we cut to the mailbox at the parents' house where it says Night, the woman behind me goes, Night.
Wait, she didn't say Shyamalan right after?
She totally plugged into what was going on there.
There's the target audience for Night and Day. I heard a woman say afterwards, yeah, it was like a romantic comedy, but with Bourne Identity.
And she went, yeah, it was awesome. Like, they liked it, and that was what she said about it.
As I was walking out, the crowd around me, both in front of me, and there's a family in front of me, and I think there's a bunch of women behind me, they were each commenting separately in their own groups about, like the father in the family was saying, yeah, he's a good-looking kid, and he's got a great smile. Tom Cruise.
He called him a kid?
He did. The guy must be Tom Cruise's age. I mean, he was this, like, 50-something-year-old dad. And he's going, yeah, he's a good-looking kid with a great smile. And then the girls behind me were going on about how Cameron Diaz was just so cute and charming and likable.
So everyone was gay.
Dingus, how did your audience respond to Night and Day?
Yes, Dingus always gets the best audience.
He does.
Oh, you guys showed me up this time. The only thing I got was walking out, and a couple girls were in front of me, and one of them said, I really loved her shoes at the end.
What? She has shoes on at the end?
I think they were talking about her boots that come back.
Oh, yeah, that she wore into the hospital inexplicably to smuggle them out of the hospital.
But
she's
like
so
her
quirky.
Shoes.
I've never seen her stretch like that, and I've never seen him play a role like that. It was amazing to watch them both, like, just expand. It's hard to get that in a summer blockbuster.
So, Kelly Wand, you did not like this movie.
I thought they should have reversed the genders, but they actually did that already. It was called Wanted, which I also didn't like.
Okay.
I thought the one part I would have liked, I started to like, and I went, no, it's not short. It's not long enough, is when they're in the montage, and she keeps getting drugged repeatedly, and then she keeps waking up, and they're on, like, a different kind of vehicle on a different continent, and then she passes out again.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that should have gone on for another 5 minutes. Like, she wakes up, she's parasailing. And then she wakes up, and they're in spacesuits on the moon. Then caveman times, and then inside a body. Like,
but overall, it did not work for you.
No, Maggie Grace. She's barely in it.
Did you want more Maggie Grace?
Way more.
Okay. Have you seen Maggie Grace in any movies, by the way, besides this?
No, she was in a remake of what? Some horror movie.
Was it Pulse? No, I've seen it, and you know what? I think it was one where hard drives come alive. I think maybe it was Pulse.
Oh, yeah.
Maggie Grace
is from Lost. Christian, you don't watch Lost, so you may not know her. But she's a terrible actress, and she cannot hold a movie, I maintain. So this movie had just the right amount of Maggie Grace. She plays April.
Oh.
She plays April Havens.
Oh, the sister. All
yes.
Right.
It's her wedding that we don't see, and we don't see her at it. She
we
was such a
wedding.
Bad actress.
We see the wedding. We go to the.
We don't see the actual wedding, do we?
Yes, we do.
See her at the.
We don't see the vows or anything, but we.
That's
see
what I'm talking
Cameron
about.
Diaz going to the wedding. there's more to a wedding than vows, Kelly Wand.
Yeah,
we don't see Maggie Grace in the wedding sequence. I go, well, at least we're going to see her in the wedding sequence, and I wait the whole movie, and
you're just
no,
disappointed.
No.
More, you wanted more Maggie Grace, okay? Well,
give
Kelly Wand, while you Google what that horror movie is, I want to turn to Dingus. Very briefly. Dingus, did it work for you?
Yep. Yep.
No, it didn't. Like in an A-team way? Like it was just the wacky fun?
I don't know. You know, there are things I really hated about it and things I'm really pissed off about it. But Tom Cruise, that kid, he's so damn charming.
He's got quite a smile.
He really does. And, you know, I'm not kidding. I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan of late, but he charmed the sock.
Whoa! Wow. That's why nobody in your audience said anything.
The statements just got dirtier.
It cleared out the theater.
That movie was The Fog, by the way, that she was in, which I didn't see.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Yep. Yes, good call.
Claire was in Hills Have Eyes. Well, let's get back to Dingus liking Night and Day, because I am fascinated already.
First of all, I want to know when I'm going to get my $5 from Kelly Wand.
I'll mail it to you. I'll mail it to you tonight.
Why does
I'm
Kelly Wand
impressed.
Owe you $5? What's going on? What's this cash transaction here?
Kelly Wand claims he'll give $5 if any of us liked this movie. And since I liked it, I get $5.
When did he
I should have said
that offer?
Before the
offer.
When all the action.
Best record, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Before we get sick of each other after you hit record.
Well, that means Kelly Wand is out $10.
Oh, stop. No way. I want the
$5. You guys.
Did he say $5 each or $5 to be split amongst the parties who liked it?
You guys.
Oh, I didn't get it in writing. Shit.
We'll take anything. That's my new theory. Any stupid action movie. doesn't matter. Doesn't
Wait a minute, Kelly Watts. That's not very fair because we all bagged on Robin Hood and Prince of Persia. We didn't like those.
Those aren't action.
Well, I would maintain that this is an action. The surprising thing to me about Night and Day, this was almost a chick flick. This was pretty much a straight-up romantic comedy that happened to have a couple of action scenes, I thought.
That you cut away from just as they're getting good.
Because they don't matter. The action sequence, this movie is not about the action sequences. This is part of what I liked about it.
That can be funny, but it definitely wasn't funny. Because it was so slow, dude.
You say slow, okay. Slow, I would say it was, go ahead.
Well, when there wasn't action, nothing was going on. A lot of nothing. A lot of battery exposition was going on. So you waited for the next action sequence, and then she'd black out in the middle of it.
Well, I'd like to explain why that worked for me. You're right. There was way too much battery exposition, and I felt sorry that they threw poor Paul Dano in there and didn't do anything with him except give him goofy facial hair. I mean, the battery stuff, you know, once they introduced that battery, I didn't need any more. I mean, it was that classic MacGuffin.
All you need is the word Zephyr, and then don't talk about anything else.
I would have loved if it was just the word Zephyr and a little silver cylinder. I mean, that would have been all I needed.
Yes, exactly.
So you're right, Kelly Watts, but the reason that it worked for me, and this will tie, I think, beautifully into our 3x3, is this movie, I didn't really need action sequences, and I didn't necessarily need the kind of pacing that I think you wanted, Kelly Wand, because all I needed from this movie was exactly what I got, and that was two very attractive leads who had great chemistry with each other, and who I just thought were incredibly likable and watchable, and even that draggy middle part where you think he's dead and it's a big fake out, you know, that, and they're going into battery talk, CIA, here's CCH Pounder, whoever that woman is, and battery talk.
Viola Davis, stop it.
I know, I'm being mean. But they do all that, and what happens is I'm like, oh, God, this movie, for Pete's sake. And then they get back together again, and the movie picks up again. And it creates this sort of tension where they're apart and the movie sags and then they get back together and I like the movie again. And that's really all this movie was to me, was, hey, Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz are just really likable, really charismatic. They seem to be having fun. They get along. There's enough banter between them to sustain the movie.
Charlie's Angels Redux.
But it wasn't – Charlie's Angels is an action movie, I would say. This is a romantic comedy. This is – This is the boy meets girl. The girl worries that the boy is not entirely conscientious and is a little bit crazy, and she has a hard time trusting him, but they get together anyway. I mean, that's the standard chick flick romantic comedy template. And this movie was that, with a little touch of Bourne Identity stuff. And I quite enjoyed it.
But you're talking about, you said tension earlier. There's no tension between them. It's instant, and they never have any, I mean... In fact, when she, quote, breaks up with him, he's actually gaining her still because he wanted all that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But that's
not tension either.
Well,
Tom said chemistry. I don't know if he said
chemistry.
He said tension too.
There was the dramatic – I mean, when they're apart –
They did have chemistry.
Right. But when they're apart, there's this – I don't know. I don't remember when I used tension. But I think you're talking about when they're apart and the movie kind of sags. Like you want.
I thought you meant there's romantic tension between.
Well, there is. There is.
No, there's not. There should be.
Well, you can use a different –
What was it based on?
Chemistry.
Okay. They hit you up chemistry, but there's nothing standing in their way. Like, they instantly like each other.
Of course there is. No. Here's what I think is in their way. I think, Kelly Wand, the mark of a really good action movie is it's about an emotion we all understand but painted larger. As a matter of fact, almost any good movie, any drama, it doesn't have to be a movie. And the tension in this movie is, and this is why I think it's a chick flick, is pretend I'm a girl while I'm talking. But the tension in this movie is shut up. The tension in this movie is, do you trust this cool boy who you've just met and who you really like? I think that right there is what Night and Day is about. It's about that female perspective on a relationship, and that's Cameron Diaz's character arc right there. And it's a big goofy spy story about that basic human emotion. And I think that's the tension right there.
And I think that could have been exponentially increased, because I think you've got the kernel of the movie
exactly right, Tom. And I think that could have been exponentially increased if they just would have gone for what I think the idea behind those drugging scenes, or what those drugging scenes should suggest the script should be, and it should have all been from her point of view up until the end when the POV shifts. And you should have seen nothing that wasn't – we don't need any of the CIA crap
right.
that he's not in the room for. We don't need to see him killing all those dudes.
It should have been like fish
on the airplane. It should have just been everything from her point of view. And just imagine walking out of that airplane bathroom, and he's sitting on that the armrest of that airplane seat with those two drinks. Because the scene that follows where she takes the drink from him and they're just bantering back and forth, I just fell for the two of them.
Yeah, me too.
They are just, first of all, he looks his age more than I remember him looking his age, which made me very happy. He's probably 48, 49 years old. She looks right. And they just have this easy way that is just, he's just comical enough. And their chemistry really surprised me. And in that little scene, after she comes out of the bathroom, I would have loved to not know anything that's going on. Just they're sort of like tussling, and the sound on the bathroom door.
Occupado.
Right out. Occupado, exactly. If it all would have been from her point of view, which I think those drugged scenes suggest, that would have been great.
And funnier. It wasn't situational enough. Like I'm talking about the action sequences being interrupted constantly, but I would have settled for them not even being in the movie and just focusing on them.
I mean, they get increasingly ridiculous. Like by the time they're on the motorcycle running from the bulls, I mean, it was almost some of the CG in that looked terrible. It was almost like
they weren't goofy enough. They look like they're trying to be real action
stars. Oh, come on, Kelly Wan. That car chase. That car chase scene where he bounces onto the car hood while she's in it and comments on her dress. Come on.
Yeah, that part's totally okay. There was one other part I liked, too. I can't remember.
And he goes flying over to the across the median onto another car, and the little kid hands him back his sunglasses. I mean, this movie had nothing. It had no intention of serious action scenes.
I like the part, too, where he jumps off an overpass and, like, a bunch of wood breaks his fall.
And then he apologizes to the guy. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know, man. A-Team was wackier than this movie. And that wasn't wacky enough. And, like, how District – I appreciated District 9 more after seeing Avatar. I kind of appreciate A-Team more. Like, now I get A-Team after seeing this movie. I go, all right. That movie was light on its feet compared to Night and Day. Because the parents – come on. That's all schmaltz, dude. There's so much schmaltz in this movie.
Well, I am going to go back to – I think it's a sort of a template chick flick romantic comedy, and it does pull a lot of punches. You know, Dingus talking about if it had all been from her perspective, that would have been more for like an art house movie. But I think this is supposed to be a summer blockbuster crowd pleaser, and it did wuss out on what could have been a lot of cool things, but it just didn't want to do those, and that's fine with me. But I think it delivered where it intended to deliver, and that is with two attractive, likable, watchable leads driving the movie. So
it's like I like them, but I didn't like the movie they were in because it wasn't crazy enough.
What about let's talk about what accent Peter Sarsgaard thought he was doing for about four or five of the lines he delivered. Does anyone have
any idea? An accent? But he was working for the CIA.
There was saying North Carolina.
Is that because I was wondering, is he trying to be Southern? And it's sort of like he did the first line and then he stopped doing it. And there were maybe two other points later in the movie where it almost seemed like he remembered that at one point he was trying to do an accent and he thought he might try again. He couldn't believe that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that either. That was sad.
Did you guys like that Feck guy?
That's Paul Dano. Yeah,
Paul Dano. Oh, right. I loved his mustache.
Oh, I hated that mustache. That was
It makes your skin crawl a little bit, doesn't it? Especially when it first shows up and it's like Fu Manchu-y out to the sides, and in the middle it's just scrubbed and
I just wanted to wipe that off of his face. It's like, oh, Paul, you got something right there, right there.
You got a smudge. So the clue he left Tom Cruise was Alps. Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
And I love, too, this is, again, for the people in the cheap seats, how Tom Cruise has to he can't just like look down the angle of the corrugated walls and then see it. And then the camera goes,
right.
He has to take a picture of it so that later on in the movie, the picture can be sitting there in the frame so the audience can be reminded of that.
Oh, yeah. All right. He had to remind himself of Alp's train.
Right. He got to make sure to get photographed.
Which is pretty specific. That is a good clue. Oh, Alp's train. Got it. Okay. Hey, so how did she get on the plane? Because I missed that part. Because I saw this with the chick who ruined Casablanca for me, and afterwards she went, I wish they drugged me.
Well, the CIA or whoever those...
voice your friend.
The counterterrorism unit or whoever they were sees the footage as Roy Harris is getting on the airplane and sees that... Roy Miller, thank you.
Oh, because...
Sees that he's handed off the knight to her, and they're like, you know what, I tell you what, let's do something different, let's put her on the plane. They see she's getting on the plane, and they engineer to have her on the plane, because I think they might think she still has the MacGuffin.
But she doesn't. They're idiots.
Because he's taken it back, but I don't think they know that he's taken it back. It's after they see her, they see him put the thing in her suitcase. They're like, okay, let her on the plane. And then he gets it back. I don't remember the chain of events, but
I think they also suspect that they might be associates somehow.
Ah, cahoots.
And they're kind of saying, let's see what happens if we throw them in here. Neither of them being on the plane makes any sense whatsoever. You know, okay. I don't understand why the hell he gets on that plane.
Well, how else is he going to get to Boston or wherever?
He could freaking
walk. Landing.
He knows everything. He knows everybody who's everywhere. I mean, he gets out of so many jams and finds a speedboat to take him to an island, and you know that he has to take a 747 or whatever plane that is. You know, with a bunch of guys he knows he's going to have to kill is goofy. I mean, the whole setup is goofy, but I don't care.
Well, is there a single non-goofy action sequence? I would say no, and that's sort of setting the tone. And I actually have a theory for why he gets on the plane, because that's a great context for chit chat. You know, that's again something everybody can relate to. Is you're on a plane and hey, there's a cute chick or whatever, and you talk to her. You know, that's a good place to unfold your beginning action sequence, I think.
But I'm talking about from a character point of view. From a movie point of view, I understand why they engineered that for him to get on there and for her to get on there as well. But from a character point of view, he gets on and he's relieved that she's not getting on. Or at least he says to her...
he warns her.
Something.
That's not a warning. What about the part where he pouts? Fine, I'll just go with my friend who trusts me instead of you. And then she goes, all right, I'll go.
When does he pout? When is that?
On that, when he drives to the parking garage after she goes...
Oh, yeah.
He just shot her friend. And he goes, all right, fine. I shot your friend. Whatever.
That guy was her ex-boyfriend. That was not her friend. It was her ex-boyfriend.
Okay, you shot my ex-boyfriend. Fine. I'll go with you to the next stupid thing.
And I like that scene a lot, too.
I love the resolution for that scene because he's so funny. Yeah. When they're leaving the place, he says such great wacky things, but them going to the pie shop is so dumb. But I love how the scene resolves. I love the things he says about Alamode, and as he's leaving the place, he says, I'll shoot myself first, and then I'll kill her.
And when he apologizes to the waiter who drops a glass, I thought you were making a move.
You're making a move. Yeah, that's good.
I love that.
That's pretty good.
I mean, and that's another thing, is this really showcased that whole Jerry Maguire, wacky Tom Cruise thing that he can do. This is just like perfect format for that, and he does that so well. Even you can tell the bits where it's sort of like he knows he's doing a bit, you know, some wacky Tom Cruise shtick, where he says, your life expectancy without me, here, with me, here, without me, with me. It's just his shtick, and it works, and it's established, and I really enjoyed it.
I'm a guy.
Yeah.
I was so pleased to see him using his sense of humor, because while I like the Mission Impossible films, he's just so much in earnest, and you see little flares of his sense of humor. But here, this is almost something more in Bruce Willis's wheelhouse, and I like it when Tom Cruise uses his sense of humor in this way, because it gives me a sense that he's being more free. I don't know that he has the ability to be more free, or be as free as he can be, because he's always in sort of control mode. But the sense that he's getting a little bit more free and using his sense of humor is so pleasing in this, because he is so charming, and they do work together very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about their chemistry as far as sexual chemistry is concerned. But I really love the chemistry in this.
There is no sexual chemistry between them. They have one kiss.
There's three, I think.
At least two.
Yeah.
There's that
wonderful between
kiss.
One and three kisses. Far short of my expectations for Night and Day.
Well, they have this wonderful kiss near the end after when she's been drugged. And she says, I don't think you're very happy to see me.
No, oh, God, I loved that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and she gets horny, yeah, because the truth serum made horny. And, but it's like, actually, I like that, too, because it's like now she likes being drugged, which I thought was kind of a funny part for her. Like, well, she's totally at peace with it now. And she gets captured on purpose to find him. I kind of like that, too. Damn it, you guys are beating me down again.
Well, if you want to see...
Stupid.
If you want to see this type of thing carried to its extreme, I think you have to see a film called Hudson Hawk.
Oh, good Lord.
No way, I'm totally with Dinkus.
It really gets sort of the madcap idea. And even this, the drugging scene where she gets drugged and she's so happy to be interrogated has an analogy in the Hudson Hawk film, which is really, if you want to go over the top, is where you go with this idea. This is much more mainstream and action-oriented. But I think if you want to go for sort of the over-the-top version of this, or where this can kind of go, you look at Hudson Hawk, and that scene where she gets drugged really remind me of the scene where...
Well, if this had had songs like Hudson Hawk, I would have liked it more.
What, you have a problem with Hall & Oates? They obviously shelled out some big money to license some Hall & Oates, and a little Christopher Cross at the end there, too.
Oh, very nice.
There was a lot of good music in this movie. And it was all 70s, wasn't it? Wasn't that the theme of the movie?
I think the movie
was their song.
That's right. Let's take apart the science. So first of all, who has a problem with the idea that the MacGuffin is the, quote, first perpetual energy source since the sun?
Oh, yeah. I like that line. Because the sun's going to die.
Spoiler. Yeah, I think they didn't know that, and I feel bad if we have to tell them that it's not perpetual, and, yeah, that the sun is going to burn out.
Well, he's not a scientist. He's crazy. He's a crazy assassin.
Is he the one that says it? I forget. Yeah, I guess it is him.
But he knows exactly when it's going to blow up. It's unstable. He knew that.
It would have been great if she had said, but the sun's going to burn out, and he had gotten suddenly doubtful.
So Sarsgaard doesn't know he needs to put it on ice, even though he wants it more even than Tom Cruise does, right?
No, Sarsgaard apparently knows nothing. I mean, Sarsgaard, it didn't even occur to him that Paul Dano could make another one until Paul Dano muttered.
Yeah.
Sarsgaard was a pretty thick-headed villain, I thought. It's not his normal clever self.
He should have beaten Paul Dano with a bowling pin on the pier.
Ah, yes. A little callback to There Will Be Blood. I like that.
Oh, is it? I just meant general. It's some random thought that came to me. Wow, so you guys like everything dumb except Toy Story. You hate Toy Story and you like Night and Day. I can see the internet now.
Yep. Well, the thing is, I mean, it you know, what is a movie trying to achieve? And I really do think that what James Mangold, and I think it was a first-time screenwriter whose name I meant to remember and forgot, I think what they were trying to achieve, they pulled off admirably. You know, it's just star-powered fluff, and it was just immensely appealing, and, yeah, I liked it. So sue me.
I think you'll like any... I think maybe June blockbusters are a distraction to me, because I expect certain kinds of movies in June, and these are all, like, August-y.
Now, what is that, like, elaborate on that. Like, what are the June ones are the good ones, and the August ones are the bad ones, or what does that mean?
Yeah, all the awesome stuff comes out in May and June. And then July, they go for the 4th, and then it kind of peters out. And then the poo comes out in August. Like, oh, who knows what Signs is going to be. But then those are, like, the really good ones. So maybe in August, you know, you're going with a lower bar, and then you wind up liking stuff more.
I guess I've never really parsed it that. Like, I haven't really thought of it that way. Dinkus, is that your experience, too? Can you see a sort of a bell curve, or not a bell curve, like an arc over the summer? there.
A chick parabola? Perhaps?
Shut up, a parabola, yeah.
There are parabolas. I was going to say that. I don't know, because I usually don't see movies all summer long, so I don't know.
When did Transformers come out last year? What part
July 4th.
Oh, ouch.
You're supposed to know. That's how they make people see it, because no one wants to see it. It's like, well, July 4th, got to go somewhere. Robots.
So this should have, what you're saying, Kelly Warren, is this should have been like a much better early summer.
I would have loved this movie in January.
Ah, okay.
It's a sleeper hit in January. Oh, wow, that great summer-like movie came out. They used some counter-marketing shenanigans. Wow, Tom Cruise movie in January? That's interesting. I haven't seen that before. Maybe it's good. Oh, wow, they spent a lot of money on this. Can't believe it came out in January. These action sequences are great. Look at that bull turn over that car.
How about him giving, like, a little, like, wink or a little nod back when the bull's about to hit the car? I love that.
Yeah. There's another wink, too, I forget.
Kelly Wan, did you like 310?
You guys are wrong. It's got a draggy middle, too, though, where they go to the mine.
Well, 310 to Yuma is also a lot smarter than this movie. I don't think this movie makes any pretensions to being like a smart or a thinking man's kind of movie or anything like that.
310 to Yuma is about characters, and this movie is not about characters.
I disagree. I think this movie is very much about characters. Like I said, I don't think the action sequences matter nearly as much as the chemistry between.
I agree with that statement, but I don't think I think there's too much action for what you're saying to be.
Do you agree though that like do you agree that the action sequences are downplayed a bit? I mean it's not enough.
Either not enough. You're going they half ass it. They give you half of something really expensive looking and then jip you for the payoff and jip you for the comedy payoff.
Well, because I think the focus in the action sequences isn't necessarily the action, it's their reaction to it. It's Cameron Diaz missing the count and or it's that conversation before the jet crashes. Or it's the fact that she finally is sexually secure enough to swing around in front of him and straddle him and shoot the guns herself. I mean, it's less about the actual mechanics and more about how the characters behave during the scenes.
Because it's a chick flick, and then chicks see movies like this, they zone out during the action sequences and are like, they're drugged.
And that's interesting because he's constantly reassuring her during the action sequence when he's on the hood of the car. And then when he gets into the car, he then encouraged, you know, he's like, you know, your time to unlock the door was sublime. I just want you to know that. You saved us.
But then she almost shoots him in the warehouse with a machine gun.
So I think that the thing is, in 310 to Yuma, there's the opening action, well, not opening, but sort of pseudo-opening action of the Pinkerton carriage getting blown up and turned over on its top. And James Mangold just fell in love with vehicles being turned over, and he just did that like gangbusters in this movie.
Except for the plane, unfortunately, which I would have.
They blew it up, though. I thought it was very nice. As a matter of fact, I loved that thing. You know, normally I hate the stupid cool guys don't look at explosions bit, but I love the fact that the plane blows up behind him while he's looking at her sleeping form, and it illuminates him, and then it just cuts to her waking up.
I would have liked if they caught fire right then.
Well, that's setting up this lovely sort of stylistic thing that I think would have worked well for her POV that I said before, that she falls into his arms in the same way a couple of times, and then he does the same thing when the POV should shift. When he gets shot, he's in her arms in almost that same pose.
Right.
And I think that would have been stylistically a beautiful – because you can't really shift POV unless you do it carefully. And if they would have done that, I think that would have made a really lovely bookend for this film instead of these you know, over-the-top action sequences.
And exposition with the bad guys talking about nothing. There's tons of it.
Oh, you don't need any of that. No matter how good the actors you get for it, you don't need it.
Again, I agree with you guys, but I was glad it was there because it made me enjoy it all the more when they finally came back on screen.
by depriving you of
yep.
it. You
went, oh, yep. Absolutely.
I'm going crazy. Yeah, he's back. This movie's awesome. Okay.
There you go. Yep. That was.
He's gone for a while, though.
He is, I know. And I'm like, oh, God, what are they going to do? Is this going to end? Oh, geez, what time is it? Should I go see Jonah Hex instead? Oh, my God. And then he comes back. And I was like, yeah, okay, good. Because that was such a great scene, too, where she's like, I feel like you're not happy to see me. I love that. That was just so adorable.
And he kisses her, his bullets.
Yes, that was just so stylistic. And again, Kelly Wan, it's not about the actions, but how the characters behave. And that was just such a perfect example of it. Is, you know what? He's going to stop dodging bullets, and he's going to be attentive to his woman for a moment. He's going
to wouldn't have been funnier if he got shot on the way to her, and he'd still gone to her like, oh, I got shot, but I'm going to...
That's the way you would have written it, and yes, I would...
That's funnier.
But see,
but she carries that off so well, that whole, you're not happy to see me, not at all.
Yeah.
And don't you just love when they're walking through and the guys one at a time are being zipped out by the rope?
Wait, what?
The henchmen. You know, when the henchmen are taking her through the palace and she's in front of them and, you know, you see one by one they get ripped out by a rope.
Oh, it's a whip. He grabs a whip.
Right.
Yes, I did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have any associations with other action movies with whips, which were also had funny things in them that were always funny. Yeah. Hey, why'd they take her to Spain to interrogate her?
Because he was a Spanish arms dealer, I guess.
Okay. They're just saving themselves a trip. Okay. I mean, they could have just, I mean, they drug her for another, never mind.
I want to talk about, so we've talked about Tom Cruise. I do want to talk some about Cameron Diaz, because I think the last movie I saw her in, was that her in that Richard Kelly thing, The Box? It was, wasn't it?
You're the only one who saw that on the planet.
I guess so. And she was terrible in it, and the material was so bad, and she just looked awful, and I think he intentionally, like, it was shot, just a really ugly, flat movie, and... But I really just was so... She was so charming, and she looked really good without looking really, like made up or overly glamorous or like she'd had plastic surgery. I mean, she looked her age, and she looked kind of real and beautiful, and she just beamed. I really enjoyed Cameron Diaz in this. And I really enjoyed how not... Well, she did. I mean, I was thinking of The Box, and I guess... You know, it did remind me of some of that sort of enthusiasm she had in the Charlie's Angels movies. And she's aged since then. And I'm glad that shows that it doesn't, that she doesn't seem to feel like she needs to be either heavily made up or get plastic surgery. I don't know. I just liked how she looked like a real woman who's like in her late 30s or whatever. And
all right. I have a theory I want to share with you now.
Okay.
And it's going to insult both of you. So get ready.
Okay.
I have a theory that since you guys are both sort of actorly and actor types, you see these movies and you go, man, Cameron Diaz is pretty fun. We could hang out with her. I'm having an actor party with my other actor friends like Bingus and Tom. But like I'm always focused on the dialogue and the writing because I'm never going to get a Cameron Diaz unlike you bastards. So I'm like, yeah, that line sucked. So I'm like, they're snarling. And you guys are like, yeah, man, that island, like totally party there. So that's why you guys like it because you're looking at people, and I'm, like, listening to stuff angrily, and you're looking at stuff. Yeah, that beach looks great, man. I totally lay down there.
Dingus, why don't you feel this one?
Is that too mean?
Maybe that's why, even though I really loved Toy Story 3, I didn't like it enough, because I'll never get together with any of those toys.
Right. this CG, I can't. This is I couldn't hang out there.
Well, Kelly Wand,
it just sucks.
Here, let me give you this, Kelly Wand. I can only imagine how this movie could have been so much better if it had also had a smart script. Because as it is, the movie was resting like 90% of this movie was carried by the actor's charisma. And if you were to also give them great material, which this movie did not do, this movie was happy to coast on their charisma, this would have been far, far better. So I will grant you that there wasn't necessarily a great script. I mean, this really was a template movie, you know, he's a spy, she's enamored of him. And
it could have been great.
Yep. Absolutely.
It makes me want to see Killers, because now I want to be like the guy who likes Killers. I'm like, yeah, see, they did it right there.
Well, I'm our resident Ashton Kutcher apologist, so I'm going to have to throw myself on that grenade at some point.
It also feels like a patchwork to me. It feels like something that
And yeah. I don't know the story about this, although I do know that it had to go through a number of reshoots. But it feels like a script that's been around for a while where things have been patched in here and there. Where, you know, like the scene Tom mentioned, the scene where the fireman wants to go have pie while she's, you know, running for her life. The setup for that scene is ridiculous, but the resolution is great. And I felt that way a lot of times in this movie, that they were just sort of patching things in and relying on their stars. But, you know, that doesn't always work for me, like, you know, Robin Hood being an example of that.
Oh,
I love Russell Crowe, and I just put in 310 to Yuma and watched a little bit of that tonight, and he's great. He's freaking great in that, and he's really charismatic and he's powerful, and you get the sense of gee, men would follow this guy. And of course I love Cate Blanchett, but in Robin Hood, that, you know, I couldn't have cared less about either one of them, and I thought they were horrible. It's not just that I want to hang out with these people, although I would have. I would be happy to hang out with Cameron Diaz. She's luminous in this.
Scientology apologist.
She's not a Scientologist, is she?
No, no.
I did find... So here's another thing, Kelly Wan, is I find watching him, like, as much as the next guy, when I'm watching Tom Cruise in a movie, I've got in the back of my head, oh, he's that crazy dude who married Katie Holmes and jumped up and down on Oprah's couch and is a Scientologist, And I lose that watching this movie. I mean, I think he's so effective that I forget about that. I'm willing to let that go.
I would, except he's as hyper in this as he is in that Scientology thing that was all over the internet. Rizal.
But I think this, it's an appropriate context for that hyperness. You know, his whole, you know, all that stuff where he's freaking out in the cafe and he thinks the waiter's making a move and like all those little jokey bits and the here's your life expectancy with me, without me. Without me, with me. With me, without me. You know, all that. I love that. I mean, it worked. You know,
I disagree that he's hyper in this. Because I think that cafe stuff that we're talking about is an act. And the stuff you see that's real is the back and forth banter when they're on the plane before the killing, when he's sitting behind her and he looks his age, and she's talking about her job as a restorer of vintage cars. Obviously, that's what she does for a living. And he's looking at her and he's just sort of feeling like, you know, it's really too bad you got on here. And he's a little bit tired and he's a little bit mellow. And he's not manic. He's not doing the manic Tom Cruise thing. And you see that a couple of times, even in the scene where he's getting her to follow him through the mansion before she says, I'm not happy here. He's mellow. He's a little bit tired. You get different things from him here. And I don't think you get the manic thing that you're talking about.
When he's bouncing off the hood of the car, when he first lands on the hood of the car, there were a few times that I guess I forgot her name was June, and I actually thought he was calling her dude, which I loved. I even wrote in my notes, calling her dude, !! And I later realized, oh no, her name is June. It's not maybe the Jerry Maguire just got fired manic bit. So it's tapping into his sort of ability to just really be comic. It's almost like Jim Carrey kind of stuff. I mean, it's shtick, and I think it works at a few times in here.
The only times he's allowed to do it, it does, but he's not doing it as much as you.
Right. It's much more restrained, and you're right, Dingus. Like, I love the parts where he is calmer. Like, I love where he explains, you know, where he sort of gets busted for putting her in her bathing suit in the bikini. Where I love where he explains that he can do it without looking. You know, I like that, and I liked how they turned that around. And
callback.
And when she tries to hit him, and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes,
I'll let you hit him next time."
Right.
He's so sincere.
Then he doesn't do it. He doesn't let her.
Well, she does just try to hit him again.
She doesn't. They go into this hustling thing instead. But there's this great moment where he says, "Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'll let you hit me this time.
I deserve it." Right.
I deserve it. It's just this great sort of relaxed and sort of mellow thing that he does. I really love how he does that in this. It's not manic. It's not over-the-top sort of wackiness.
The Russell Crowe character in 310 to Yuma was more human-sized, and he was, as we, spoiler alert, he winds up being vulnerable.
But that movie's
that iconic sort of man with no name Western hero.
But Tom Cruise is iconic Tom Cruise. And
no,
he's actually
no,
like Tom
he's not. He's boyfriend. He's shorthand for cool.
That's Tom Cruise. He's the Jerry Maguire as by way of Mission Impossible. He's half Jerry Maguire and half Ethan, what's his face?
Kelly Wand.
That's good. That's not bad, actually.
I think you need to let yourself go, Kelly Wand, and enjoy movies that aren't necessarily so good.
All right, quarter to three.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, need a partner free.
Let's do a 3x3. You guys with me?
Yeah.
No.
What do you mean? What was that?
I owe those $5.
Thing is, you sound reluctant. 3x3. It ties in so perfectly with what we saw this week. What?
Yeah, it does.
It really does, actually. Yeah.
Oh. Spoiler.
Whose was it?
It doesn't for you guys. Yeah.
This was yours, right?
I feel better about it than when I... Yeah, this is mine.
Okay, tell us.
Because there's something dumber. It's three least convincing ever screen couples.
Okay.
I have a lot of good runners-up, and I have one good one, and then two suck. Spoiler alert.
Okay. Dingus, why are you groaning? You don't like this?
I had a harder time with this than I expected because there's a lot of low hanging fruit and I tried to avoid that.
I tried to. Okay. Yeah.
But also, Dingus finds every couple convincing because he's a man in love.
Right. Like you guys, I totally buy you two.
What was that?
What?
All right. So, Dingus, you're up first because you're going to be giving us a 3x3 for next week. So, what is your number three least convincing couple?
Okay. So, least convincing couples. At first, I really tried to think of movies I really like that had least convincing couples, but and tried to confine myself to that, sort of thinking along the lines of what, you know, Tom usually gives himself a task, and that didn't really work out for me. So I went with the only thing I really constrained myself was trying not to make them least convincing because of the disparity in attractiveness. But I don't even know if that worked. So anyway, my number three least convincing couple, and I'm not going to bother to give a quote from it because I don't think anybody would ever get it. But it's a film called The Good Shepherd from 2006. It was directed by Robert De Niro.
I don't think there's any women in that movie.
Yeah.
It's not about women because it's all about the dudes. No, it's Matt Damon and Angelina Jolie.
Angelina Jolie is in that movie? I don't think you're right, Dingus.
Maybe I just dreamed that she was in it.
I'd totally forgotten she was.
Or maybe he uses salt at some point. I'm not sure. she of course, are you kidding me? Stop pulling my leg. She plays his wife in it. There's a lot that doesn't work in this movie. There's a lot that makes it... seem interminable. I think it's like 170 minutes, 160 something minutes. It's a really long movie. And they're a married couple, or they're supposed to be a married couple, and they just have nothing. There's just nothing there.
Isn't that kind of the point of the movie, though? I mean, not really the point of the movie, but isn't that intentional?
That's kind of what is difficult about this, is because it's supposed to be a troubled marriage, and there's supposed to be elements of this that you see as the movie progresses, that the marriage has more and more troubles, and both of them end up being tempted in different ways. But for me, watching it, there was just nothing there. The root of this is I think she's completely wrong for this. So that sort of sets up the idea that as a couple they're not going to really be convincing, because I think she's wrong for this character and wrong for this movie. Mm-hmm. I think she's far too knowing for this movie. But the thing I remember vividly from having first seen it, and there's not a whole lot I remember from it because it just drags on for me, it dragged on forever, was the feeling that there's so little chemistry between the two of them. I honestly felt like Matt Damon had more chemistry with the kid who was playing his son than he had with her, and bordering on sort of a sexual type of chemistry. I just thought there was nothing between the two of them. She was completely wrong with this, and they were just completely unconvincing for me as a couple, regardless of what marital troubles they're supposed to be having.
Because I actually had, until you'd said that, I had forgotten she was in it. And I'm remembering her now in the scenes with them. But it does, like, that's a tough call, though. Like, like, does the fact that it's showing that they have this loveless marriage eventually, you know, and therefore the lack of chemistry, doesn't that in a weird way kind of serve that that character arc?
And I did have trouble with that. There were a couple other choices I had to just sort of say, well, that's supposed to be an element of their marriage,
right?
And give it up. There's some heat there or whatever. But for me, that was one of the elements of this that really stuck out when I saw this movie,
right.
was how there was nothing in that relationship, and it really ruined what there was for me.
Right.
I think there's a lot of things wrong with this movie, but that was one of them.
Good. Which one?
I see it. Does that help?
It's one of those chore movies. I quite liked it, but it really does take, you know, you've got to really buckle down and sit through something that's pretty drawn out. And yeah, so I would say
it's about the CIA getting formed. So it sounds like a biopic, and that's why I dodged it.
And it plays like one too. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what it's all about, though? Like, I don't want to say too much, but I will never forget the payoff in that movie. Like, the final, I don't know if it's the final scene, but, you know, what the character finally comes to and what he does is just such this, like, really stark, chilling image that stuck with me. So, you know, it's a chore movie, but I think it's got enough of a payoff that I recommend it.
Chore movie?
Yeah.
You mean like Night and Day?
Night and Day is a dessert movie.
It's Night and Day. It's night compared to the day. Wait.
All right, I'm going to do my number three. My number three are Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett in that Benjamin Button movie. Who just
very close on that.
Oh, man. My God, there's just nothing between them. Just nothing. And I don't know if it's because they were so busy CGing Brad Pitt most of the time, or if it's just because it's a terrible script, or because it plays like a B story. I mean, there's this whole idea that the Benjamin Button movie is being narrated by an elderly Cate Blanchett recalling what happened, and it just cuts back and forth, and then there's the whole thing with him going backwards in time, and just in all of that shuffle, there was no connection and no spark between the two of them, and they're both very good actors. They can both do really good stuff, and there's just no sign of that in this Benjamin Button movie. So,
that was a good movie.
Did you not see that?
No, I saw the trailer and I went, oh, he ages backwards? All right, I don't need to see it. I know
but
what happens at the end.
But you know, it's David Fincher, though.
He crawls into a womb. Right, but I'm not I know it's a trick.
Okay.
Am I wrong? Is it just a gimmick? Like, I can't imagine.
Yeah, no, it's a gimmick and it's a sloppy mess and...
But it's based on a wacky Fitzgerald story, right?
You know, isn't Robert Zemeckis somehow involved, or did I just make that up?
He's involved with a lot of CG, so that would.
It has the feel of it has
the reason
like
you
Forrest
think.
Oh, it's the Forrest.
It's Forrest Gump, right?
Right. You know
right,
what? Yeah.
Right, right.
The parallel.
It's the same writer, by the way.
Yes, exactly, and the same plot points. That's what I'm thinking of.
That guy must be able to hang himself if you're writing both.
David Fincher does Robert Zemeckis doing Forrest Gump. Yeah.
That's just what I want to see. I totally want to see that movie.
It's horrible.
Don't get Dinkus started, or he will literally start yelling, and I'll have to like turn down the little sound amplification
button. I'll give him $5 if he yells about Benjamin.
There's one moment in that movie where I felt like there was a moment of chemistry between the two of them, but
by accident.
It is in the service of something that is so artificial and.
She starts aging backwards, and then they.
No, I don't even want to get it.
Not the gazebo. Nothing in the gazebo, is it?
No, it's in. I
assume they have chemistry when he's aging back to the point where they're the same age, like he catches her.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is that they have this
one day
middle
with a thing.
And obviously, yeah, right. It's the conceit around which this short story was built. And it just doesn't support a movie, especially when the two leads. Because that's the thing is, you should want the leads to be together. And when they're constantly being pulled apart, that's like dramatic tension, and that makes for a good movie. But when it's all a gimmick,
so it's Flowers for Algernon, but chronological instead.
Ah, very good, very good.
That's not a movie.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Wait, what was it called?
We're actually riffing on adaptation. It's a great scene where Charlie Kaufman is asking Donald, you know, are there any movies about flowers? And Donald says, well, Flowers for Algernon. And Charlie Kaufman says, says that's not a movie. And Donald Kaufman says, oh, well, I didn't see it.
That's pretty good. Wish I'd seen that tonight. Wish Charlie Kaufman had written Night and Day instead of the people who wrote it.
All right, Kelly Wan, what is your number three least convincing couple?
My number two is the good one, so I'm just going to say my number three and you go, oh, yeah, right, and then we'll just move on because it's not that interesting even to talk about.
Okay.
Number three is Arnie and Jamie Lee Curtis in True
Oh, my
Lies.
God, that is a good one.
That's good, yeah.
That whole dance scene, doesn't she, like, do a striptease or dance or do some creepy sexy dance thing?
Yeah, and he has...
Why didn't you give us a quote from that, Kelly Wand?
Who has time for that?
We do.
I don't want to make the listeners wait to hear True Lies said.
That is a good one, though.
Yeah, don't they suck in that?
Wow.
But it almost makes me wish they were married so we could, like, hear about it and read about it. Like, that would definitely be a marriage. I don't really care about famous people's private lives. Like, I don't know who Heidi and Spencer are. I hear that phrase over and over, so someone gives a shit somewhere. But, like, if Arnold Schwarzenegger and Angie Millie Curtis were married, if she dumped Christopher Guest for Arnie, and Maria Shriver married Christopher Guest, obviously, like they did in Denise Richards, I'd follow that every week, wouldn't you? Like, on YouTube and Facebook.
That would be nice, yes.
Okay, that's my three. Very Sorry. Good.
All right, Dingus, ha-ha, top that for your number two. What do you got?
I don't remember. It was True
Lies. Thanks, James Cameron.
Benjamin Button. It's the same thing. Yeah, but they were all bad.
Oh, he's hard to pair up with anybody, though, but especially her.
Except
really?
Danny DeVito.
Yeah, that's true. His nipples feel sensitive in that, by the way. Spoiler alert.
One, two, three. And he got Kelly. In a couple with somebody where it was convincing?
Kelly Preston. He nails her in Twins.
Nails.
I think the best pairing with Arnold Schwarzenegger is with Carl Weathers in Predator.
Can you do a line from that for us?
Dutch. Duh. That's all I got.
I don't like that movie because it doesn't show the engine die that I was looking forward to on the bridge. Spoiler alert.
All right.
Does that help you?
Yes.
What are we talking about?
Wait, Mendingus, give us your number two least convincing couple. You got to top Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis. Either that or resign.
I'm not going to top it, and I'm not going to resign.
Give me $5.
I'm not going to use a quote either because this movie so disappointed me. And this couple, maybe not at the center of why it disappointed me, but part of the problem. And actually one of the members of my couple is the actress that you just mentioned, Tom, Cate Blanchett.
Mm.
And the actress
Oscar what? And Lucinda?
I'm scared. You're gonna scoop me.
I doubt it. The actress she's working opposite is Owen Wilson. And the movie they're in is The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. And I was so disappointed by this movie. And Kelly Wand always tells me to offer up my Wes Anderson films early on, usually for a different reason, because Tom's going to scoop me. No doubt neither of you will scoop me in this, because I don't think anybody feels so strongly about this as I do. But I love Wes Anderson, and I went to see this film in a preview, really having high hopes for it, and I was really pretty disappointed. And then just a couple months ago, I watched it again, I think, maybe just in December, which is more than a couple of months ago, but it was in December to prepare for something or other. Maybe it was the Fantastic Mr. Fox show we did. And it was almost unwatchable for me. And part of the reason is that they just are so awful. She's supposed to be falling in love with him. And she's doing this odd, she's doing this sort of Katharine Hepburn thing she does sometimes. And he is doing this weird... weird Southern, like if you can imagine somebody from the Stephen Colbert Report show reading a Civil War letter, kind of an accent. And the two of them together, she could be hot as a pregnant woman. She's this like pregnant chick who's pregnant with her boss's baby, and she's kind of
messed up in the head, and she's a reporter following this documentary that they're doing, and I just was so annoyed by their relationship, and when you're supposed to really sort of be swept up in it, and so yeah, that's my next unconvincing couple.
You know what, Dingus? You have made me want to rewatch Life Aquatic now. I hope you're happy.
I am very happy.
Because now I'm curious. I'm like, I don't remember it being that bad. So now I am like,
well, I'm particularly disappointed because I love Wes Anderson so much, and this movie felt like such a half-hearted remake of Royal Tenenbaums that and nobody feels like they're in the right part. They all felt like they just shuffled the theater company up, and everybody took a different part, and nothing seems to work. And Bill Murray even says to Owen Wilson at one point, "I want you to be in this documentary we're doing because we have chemistry." And nobody has chemistry in this, in particular these two who are supposed to be falling in love. So anyway, there you go.
I didn't think she was falling in love with him. I thought she was just on the rebound from Bill Murray, who was getting on her nerves.
I think she's definitely supposed to be falling for him.
Doesn't really? Wouldn't you say, though, that Willem Dafoe has chemistry in this movie?
He's got accent.
I like that movie more than most people like it, but it's not that great. I don't know. It didn't offend me like it did everyone I know.
It just disappointed me. It really let me down.
It's no Rushmore, and it's no Tannenbaums, and it's no every other Wes Anderson movie. It's no Fantastic Mr. Fox. But it's better than 90% of the blockbusters we've seen this summer.
There's that.
That you liked. Just kidding.
Well, my number two, neither of you guys have seen, I bet. And I would recommend it on... So I've talked before. I hope I'm not scooping anyone. But I didn't want to pick anything that I've talked about before. Like, there are several Jennifer Aniston romantic comedies where she's just wretched. So I didn't go for that. That's that low-hanging fruit. But this movie is on par. There's a movie called Derailed with Clive Owen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that I almost recommend watching just because how terrible they are together. But this movie I absolutely recommend watching for how horrible the romantic leads are with each other. Yeah. And it's a Western called Appaloosa with Ed Harris and Renee Zellweger. And she's a widower who's come into town, and I think he's the sheriff there or something. And it is – I can't even begin to describe it. I mean, you could be generous – and you could say they're quirky, but it's this supposedly gritty Western. It's based on a Robert Parker novel, and it's just so embarrassing to have these two actors playing their romance in this gritty Western, like it's some sort of mawkish puppy love. And they're just like, she looks weird and he looks so ill at ease, and it's just horrible. And in one sense, you could think, this must have been what it's like back in the Old West when, you know, somebody who's not comfortable with courting and somebody who is a widower, maybe this is what it's really like. But you can't. I swear if you watch this, you cannot excuse it like that. It's just two actors who are just so ill at ease with each other having to play a romance, and it's fascinating. So, you know, I got to recommend the awfulness of Renee Zellweger and Ed Harris in Appaloosa. There you go.
Dingus, you see it?
I have not seen it. Thankfully, Tom sort of warned me away from it.
Hmm. See, now it makes me want to see it.
I know. It's like Dingus talking about Cate Blanchett and Owen Wilson at Life Aquatic. I want to go back and watch that now. The problem is the rest of Appaloosa, like, it's only one subplot. You know, Appaloosa is a more conventional Western, and even Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen, they're supposed to be like, Viggo Mortensen is supposed to be a sidekick. Even they have awkward chemistry there. Just the whole movie is weird and awkward, but particularly notable is Ed Harris and Renee Zellweger.
I can't picture them together in my fantasies, so you're right.
Yeah.
And I can picture damn near anything.
And the thing is, they're both good, too. Like, they're both good actors. You know what? It's like my thing. My number one of the actors is terrible. But, like, my number two, and actually I think all of us, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I was going to say we're all talking about good actors who don't have chemistry. But Renee Zellweger, for instance, in, but like, Down with Love with Ewan McGregor. I mean, God, she's brilliant in that.
Yeah.
And Appaloosa's probably just a couple years after that, I think. So,
I think we all consider Cate Blanchett a really talented actress, but spoiler alert, we all have a Cate Blanchett entry in our lists.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's right, Kelly Wand. You were worried about getting scooped. All right, well, Kelly Wand, what's your number two? Is it your Cate Blanchett one?
No, that's my number one.
Okay. What's your number two?
I do them in order. I don't lead up to stuff. It just happens. This is the second least convincing ever couple.
All right.
Sorry. I don't remember a single quote from this movie except the setup of the movie. It's Cusack and Beckinsale in Serendipity.
Ooh.
And it's not that I don't consider them like bad together, but just the plot of the movie, I can't picture these people existing. Like, they both want the same pair of gloves at Bloomingdale's. That's how they meet. And he writes his name, phone number on a $5 bill, and she writes hers on a copy of Love in the Time of Cholera. And they each take one glove. And then years pass, they get engaged to other people, and they spend the whole movie missing each other by like 5 seconds. And then at the end, after they're married, they spend every anniversary drinking champagne at Bloomingdale's together and buying gloves again for luck. And then they
Oh, I did not see it, and that does not make me want to see it. Ew.
Right. I just can't believe any couple. Like, if a girl was – that would, to me, be a sign that I'm not supposed to be with someone.
That is an awesome choice, Kelly. I think I must have blocked that film out. That's one of those films where you're pressed into service as a husband that you have
right.
to see. How did you – why would you end up at that movie?
Because look at her. I like Beckinsale. Every man does, doesn't they?
Kelly likes her so much that his grandma goes out the window.
Yeah, it takes quite a woman to make me that stupid. Except for an entire podcast.
A tough man to make a tender woman.
She's hot, but I think if she said, all right, you have to, if you can only go out with me if you find this book and I find this $5, like, I would take that as a blow off. You know, she's not interested. She's so interested she's going to ditch someone she's engaged to years from now. Based on personal experience, that's been the case. Because I hear that all the time from girls. Okay, I'll sleep with you, but you have to find this book. And I'm mailing it to Italy right now.
It's by John Grisham.
I don't think I'm going to scoop anyone, but I almost picked a Cate Beckinsale movie, but it was too obscure, and it had more to do with the guy in it than with her. But she plays the ex-wife of Sam Rockwell in a movie called Snow Angels.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, there's so much uncomfortable stuff in that movie, but partly, and actually they're kind of believable in terms of where they come to, but it's just such a clumsy movie, and it has such a weird, it goes in such a weird direction that I don't think the actors earn, and part of the problem is that I just don't really feel the connection between them going to that length, and I don't think either of them's really a strong enough actor in the parts they're cast in.
Yeah. Isn't she a waitress in that? Which I also don't believe. From the guy, like, I'm already going, all right, yeah, the kid Beckinsale's a waitress.
She is, but
in the Chinese restaurant, you can see her being a Chinese restaurant waitress.
Ah.
Oh, she's Chinese in it? Then I understand.
Well, this will sell it. This will explain it to you, Kelly Wand. I mean, I think Snow Angels is supposed to be sort of Southern Gothic in terms of its tone and where it eventually goes.
I don't like all these movies Kate Beckinsale makes that are snow-themed like that and Whiteout, even though she takes a shower in Whiteout.
She's not
like
bad in Whiteout. I kind of like it. She actually is a convincing couple in a way with Tom Skerritt. Is it Tom Skerritt? Who's like her mentor in Whiteout?
But I'd just rather see her in Tropical Climes. Like,
I see. You want to see. I see. Yeah. I should have known. Right. Of course.
it's a trap.
Kelly Wand, would you have liked Night and Day better if it was Cate Beckinsale and Tom Cruise?
Hells yeah. That's an easy one. Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say Killers. Like, I'd rather. I like Heigl. What's up with Heigl? Didn't Heigl go, like, she turned down the Emmy because she said the writers had given her the right material with that show she's on, Grey's Anatomy? But then she does Killers, like, that script is awesome.
Katherine Heigl is in Grey's Anatomy?
That's how she got her start, didn't it?
Yeah. She's a TV person? Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. She was a 14-year-old sex pod in My Father the Hero, which is where Tom's remembering her from. Grey's Anatomy put her on the map. Then she made Knocked Up. Then she said, that sucks, and Grey's Anatomy.
But I'll do Killers.
Then she made, yeah, but I'll do Killers. Like,
I think all signs are pointing to Killers being awesome.
Yeah.
It has to be. Because Kutcher's in it, your favorite wrestler actor.
All right, Kelly Wand, or no, Dingus, what is your number one least convincing couple?
All right, this is my lowest of the hanging fruit that I picked for this particular list. And the only one of these that has an actress, oh, oops, I gave it away, that has one of the actors who's really just truly bad.
Wait. We've been given a hint. Let's try and guess it. Actress is.
Now, you know what? I'm worried he's going to scoop me. Surely he's not going to scoop me.
No, there's no way you would pick this, Tom.
I don't know. I don't know, Dingus. I'm worried about my number. My number one I didn't hit on until shortly before we started recording, and I'm worried that I don't think it's Kelly Wands because it's not Kate Blanchett. But I'm worried. Go ahead, Dingus. What is it?
No, it's not so yours. Bad.
All right.
You're going to think I'm dumb for picking this, but that's fine. You know what? I think I'll give you fellas a quote, and you'll be able to guess it right off the bat.
Okay.
That's how Austrians say goodbye.
Bruno. Bruno and that Asian dude. That's convincing. Bruno and his PA, Lutz. You didn't like. Valkyrie, Tom Cruise.
The thing is, Bruno and Lutz were actually fairly convincing, though.
Yeah, they were.
They were quite. They were the best thing about that horrible movie. Austrians say goodbye. Oh, Valkyrie, yeah.
No.
It's not like Hitler doesn't say that line to Tom Cruise when he tries to assassinate him?
No.
Okay.
That's how Austrians say goodbye. Wait, that sounds really familiar. That's how Austrians.
But he did it in an accent. Die Hard. Isn't Hans.
Hans Gruber. Spoiler.
All right, I'll give you the line that comes right after that.
Okay.
And this is how we say goodbye in Germany.
Oh, wait, it's Allison Duty.
Duty!
Sean Connery? Or Harrison Ford and Allison
Duty. Yeah, it's Allison Duty.
Oh, my God! By the way, that's another one where Kate Blanchett really turned in some awesome work.
Yeah.
Just missed it, though, because I went with number three instead of number four.
So, wait, yeah. it's the Nazi chick, that random blonde Nazi chick who played the romantic opposite?
She's barely in the movie.
Right,
it's
exactly.
An interesting choice. That's why it's dumb.
What is her name?
Allison Duty? I don't know her real name. But she thanks Connery's character, too, which makes it kind of funny.
Right. The actress's name.
It's improvisation. Yeah.
She's horrid.
What's her name? Dingus, what's the actress's name?
Allison Duty.
Allison Duty.
How do you spell that?
Duty.
D-O-D-Y. Silent K. Wait, she's in Moonraker or something, too. No, she's in View to a Kill or something. She's in a Bond movie.
I believe you. Okay.
So this is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, right? So break it down for us, Dingus. What?
All right, this is the Last Crusade, and this gets to my number one because of the steady deterioration of female
his love interests
in Indiana Jones,
all the way to Karen Allen, number four.
And how horrid! She's horrible, and he is so bored. He, you know, he can't be bothered to even try to sort of make any sort of spark happen, and they have this love scene that is so awkward, and even her kiss when she says, "This is how Austrians say goodbye," is just without any spark whatsoever.
I prefer the Austrian version. That's the payoff.
Exactly. And at least you have Sean Connery there making jokes about also having slept with her, which is hilarious. My dad slept with her, too. That's so funny.
She drools when she sleeps or something. Doesn't he say something like that? Which I think he came up with. That's his line. It's pretty funny.
And it's just, you know, when you look at Karen Allen and how she's the least conventionally beautiful of them and how incredibly attractive she is, at least to me, and how what a spark she is in that movie and just how they have such great chemistry and they work together so well in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then you move on to Kate Capshaw, and she's very beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And she's more comical and wacky and musical theater-y, as the beginning shows, and that works fine too. It's a little disappointing to lose Karen Allen.
They're just a fling, though.
Yeah, it's just a fling.
All right.
The time has shifted, but it was still disappointing for me because I loved Karen Allen so much, and I would have liked to see her again, but there's no way you can really do that given what they're trying to do with sort of the romantic comedy action thing that they're doing with those movies. And then we land into the third movie with this thud of Allison Duty, and she's this Austrian archaeologist,
double agent.
Scientist, double agent, and she's just, she has nothing. She's
obsessed
horrible.
With the Grail. She
and
dies.
There is nothing between them, and they try to do this witty banter when they first meet, where he tries to give her a flower, and she says, "I normally don't do this. I don't either." And but there's no zing, there's no spark. You know, Denham Elliott is stumbling along behind them, saying, "Wait for me." It's just. Oh, it just is like having a stone around your neck, and so much could have been done if they could have just. I don't know how. I don't know what the backstory is. I don't know how she ended up. I have no idea what the casting is, but she is so bland and uninteresting and barely attractive. I mean, she's got sort of a blondness to her, but that's about it. Oh, she's horrible. Horrible.
I consider that a very weird choice because she's not in the movie very much. Like, it's not really about her. It's about him and Connery, and like Connery's his love interest.
Well, certainly, but they are sort of a couple, and he is paired with somebody, and she disappears, I think, at the 1 hour mark.
Yeah.
But I think of him as having a love interest in being in a couple in these movies, at least because of what happens in the first movie. And there's such a promise there in that first movie, and to have it get to the third movie and just go, disappointed.
Well, but it's his crappy chemistry with her that drives him back to Karen Allen. Like, yeah, Karen Allen was better than these stupid blondes. Although then they ruin it with the fourth movie. Like, our imagination would have been better.
Well, that, you know, it does, I don't want to get too much into Night and Day, but it really does. It's like Dingus was talking about, the deteriorating quality of the Indiana Jones movies partly has to do with pairing him opposite like a strong, you know, a woman with whom he has chemistry. That's such a hugely effective way to get the audience wrapped up in screen action, you know, and it's a shame that we successively lost that in each of the Indiana Jones movies. So,
and Star Wars, we had Han Solo and Princess Leia, and then there's no Han Solo analog in the prequels, so they all suck.
Yeah, let's not get on a discussion of the prequels.
Let's do one podcast without Star Wars.
That's the lowest hanging fruit of all.
It's for the listeners, dude.
I mean,
June.
So my number one actually can it's similar to Dingus's, but in a way I don't want to talk about my number one so much as I want to talk about how it was eventually fixed. Because the problem with my least convincing screen couple, the movie was fine, but they were just so terrible in it. But in the sequel, they addressed this, and I adore how they addressed it in the sequel. So, to get to what my least convincing screen couple is, it's Katie Holmes and Christian Bale in Batman Begins. There's nothing there. She's just terrible. I mean, it's mainly because she's a terrible actress, and, you know, there's no sense that he cares for her, and none of that matters. I mean, it's just such an inconsequential part of the movie. Who even remembers that she was in it? It's that kind of thing.
I do.
But what I love, though, is that in Batman Begins is that they just replaced her with Maggie Gyllenhaal, and talk about someone who's not conventionally beautiful. But you still see she serves her purpose in that movie so incredibly well, because you still see her, the attraction she has with both Christian Bale and Aaron Eckhart. The fulcrum between those two characters, and you see how they care about her and how she cares about them, and it's not just because she's hot. You know, I love that part of Dark Knight. I mean, Dark Knight gets so many things right, and replacing Katie Holmes with Maggie Gyllenhaal to create this triangle between Aaron Eckhart, Christian Bale, and Maggie Gyllenhaal is just one of the brilliant things in that movie. And I haven't seen Batman Begins, I guess, probably since it was in theaters. Dingus, you've watched it fairly recently, haven't you?
Well, I watched it right before we went to see Dark Knight.
Okay. And then she's so is it just that there's no good, I mean, she's terrible, right? Like, Katie Holmes just doesn't know what she's doing.
I didn't find her to be terrible, but the difference is stark when you see them one night after the other, because there just doesn't seem to be anything going on behind her eyes, and you could never say that about Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
But how would it have affected you if Katie Holmes got blown up in Dark Knight instead of Maggie Gyllenhaal?
See, that's the thing is, it you know, when we talk about convincing screen couples, I just can't see, you know, Aaron Eckhart. You know, I can't see Katie Holmes struggling with what Maggie Gyllenhaal has to struggle with in Dark Knight, which is, I mean, it's subtext, it's behind her eyes, it's you know, when she's having conversations, saying one thing to Christian Bale, where he thinks, ah, she's going to be with me, but she's not. She's basically telling him goodbye, and she's going to leave him the note. Like, imagine Katie Holmes trying to do all that stuff, and it just wouldn't have worked, I thought.
It's just hard for me to, like, watch Dark Knight and not go, I'm supposed to pretend it's Katie Holmes. So I, like, superimpose her, but with Maggie Gyllenhaal's acting.
I think you're supposed to forget Katie Holmes.
But it's part of... Doesn't Katie Holmes also take out the Scarecrow at the end of Batman Begins with, like, a taser? And that's, like, the last...
Oh, my God!
And on a horse. He's, like, just rides a horse into the fog, and that's, like, the resolution of that whole saga.
Like something out of Night and Day.
Which means you liked it. Get it in Dark Knight and...
Ah, because they spelled it the same way.
And his name's Roy Miller. Wait.
Knight.
No, wait, yeah. Okay, so Roy Miller. Henry Miller. Her name's June. Henry and June.
Well played, Kelly Wand.
There you go.
All right, Kelly Wand, so your number one has Cate Blanchett. Should we guess? Because
yeah.
I thought we tapped out the terrible...
No.
It can't be her and that Martin Sokek guy in Lord of the Rings.
Is it her and Leonardo DiCaprio?
No.
When is she paired with Leonardo DiCaprio, Dingus?
Isn't she in The Aviator with him?
Oh, yeah. They were convincing.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's good in that. That's a hard role to play.
She's great in that, but I'm trying to guess what you're going for.
It's not Cusack in Pushing 10, spoiler alert. Also with Jolie, another unconvincing.
All right, tell us who the dude is. Will that give it away?
It's a giveaway, yeah. I'm stunned that you guys haven't just stumbled on it.
Is it a chick?
Is it Cate Blanchett herself?
She plays herself in this.
So it's coffee and cigarettes.
She doesn't play a queen.
Is she Bob Dylan? Does she play Bob Dylan in this?
It's Robin Hood. We just saw it.
Well, I didn't know you were going to go so contemporary.
Yeah, that's my number one. Something I just saw.
All right.
Ooh, Robin Hood. Yeah, when she's taking off his armor.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
She's like, I can tell she's thinking, God, this guy's fat. And then when she smiles at him and they kiss, like, right after her dad's funeral, I'm like, God, what a cold-hearted bitch. Already looking ahead. Never mind.
Kelly, what? I want you during certain movie scenes to narrate the character's thoughts for us. I love that.
That should be a DVD
I can only do
feature.
Women.
Seriously, I want that as a DVD feature.
I want that too.
No, I don't want to ruin stuff. Outside of these podcasts, except for an hour a week talking to you guys and then get flamed for it.
Well, tell you what, Kelly Wand, one more time, I want you to just do your rendition of what Cate Blanchett is thinking while she's taking Russell Crowe's armor off.
God, he's fat. It's like a ham hock. Ugh. Hideous. Ingrown back hair. Ugh. God.
What color is his eye?
I could have had Max von Sydow.
Very good, Kelly Wand. That made me happy. All right, so what do we got coming in?
Wait, there's other number ones, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, so what are some runners-up?
Didn't Dingus did not do his number one?
Dingus's number one was...
Indiana Jones. Yeah.
Oh, Indiana Jones, all right. Sorry.
Yeah, right.
He had to go first because he's doing the 3x3 for next week. Yeah.
I forgot the rules of this non-game we play. My runners-up were Streisand and Redford in The Way We Were, which I never saw. Liza Minnelli and Arthur, or Liza Minnelli and anyone. the guy's in She's Out of My League, and the girl who's out of his league.
Ah.
And Estevez and Ally Sheedy in Breakfast Club. I found that a little convincing.
What about Liza Minnelli and is his name Tony Hale, the guy in Arrested Development? They were great.
That's not a movie.
Good point. Very good point.
This is a movie cast.
I'm going to save that for my TV podcast that I do with my other friends.
Okay, Tom, what's the lowest hanging fruit that you can think of for this list?
It's not Derailed?
Well, it would, it would be another Clive Owen thing.
Duplicity, yeah. Like, Duplicity would have been too easy. And that I'm not even sure they're a couple, though. They're like a hideous monster. That's like a horror movie. That's more like Dead Ringers, you know. But with,
yeah.
Wow, Duplicity, yeah, of course. I didn't even entertain that. That's just too frightening.
Right. Well, I think the very lowest hanging fruit would have to be Hayden and Portman.
Oh, yeah.
Don't even register. They're for kids. They're cartoons. Why do?
Quit thinking. They're supposed to be a couple, goofball. Shut up.
George Lucas and kids are too young to understand adult relationships.
See, I don't even. That's not even hanging fruit. That doesn't even count. Those aren't even. Those are merchandising tie-ins.
Tom Cruise and Thandie Newton in Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah, that's a good one. I agree. I like it. A+. Heather Thomas and Willie Ames were pretty convincing and Zapped, by the way.
Good. Managed to work that in. Good.
Because they weren't falling in love. That's what I miss about movies. Movies about just people getting laid. Like in American Pie, they all have to like join the Glee Club and discover themselves. In old times, in our teen movies growing up, it was just about, you just had to get laid, and that was like the whole plot of the movie. That's all you needed. Not redemption.
All right, so Dingus, what do you have for us for next? What are we going to do for our next 3x3? Is this a good one?
This is going to be tough for you guys.
Uh-oh. You make it sound like you've already got yours planned out.
Let's try and guess what it is.
Usually I've got a couple safeties. And I could only think of one safety, so I'm going to be thinking, I'm going to be scrambling this week.
All right.
But this is sort of inspired by Knight and Day. And this is...
That's what it is, because it's a hard K, Cruz, and Day sounds like Diaz. Okay.
Knight and Kaday. All right,
yeah.
And this coming week's 3x3 is least likely jobs.
What? I need details, please.
All right, so Cameron Diaz in Night and Day, is her job is restoring old automobiles. And she's a super hot girl who restores old automobiles. And I don't want to – that's not a spoiler because she reveals that within the first 10 minutes of the movie. And whether or not you believe that's what she actually does for a living is up to you. The film – tries to justify it, and that's fine. But there's a number of jobs that actors end up having and characters end up having in movies that they say, oh, I'm this, I'm that, and you have to sit there and go, really, that's your job? So you have to come up with three least likely jobs, and to make this a little bit easier for you, I'll let you also use hobbies. So
no!
No. Don't make it easier.
Yeah, because I've already got mine, and they're all from the same movie.
All right, then just jobs and least likely jobs. And you guys were so whiny a minute ago, I thought I would have to open it up. So good.
All right, so there you go. All right, so
just,
go ahead, Kelly Wand.
I just got confused, but then when he broke it down, I understood.
Yeah. No, I like it. Yeah.
Now I like it, yeah.
All right, so join us next week for our 3x3 least likely jobs. Also, we will be seeing Twilight Eclipse.
I'm camped out at it right now, by the way.
Live from the line at Man's Chinese Theater with his mom, Kelly Wand.
Yeah. I'm in drag.
No, we're not going to see Twilight Eclipse.
Don't notice.
So I'm going to. I have saved us from that by suggesting a movie that comes out on DVD on, I think, the 29th. So we're taping this on a Sunday. So Tuesday, out on DVD, is a movie called Don McKay, first-time director, movie with Thomas Hayden Church and Elizabeth Shue, that I saw, and I heartily recommend. We'll talk more about it next week when all three of us will have seen it. So see Don McKay. Join us next week. And we will also be talking about our three least likely jobs. I am Tom Chick, and I am here with Christian Mirzini. Did I get that right?
Mirzini. It's Christian Murawski.
Ah, I was close. Okay, yeah, I'll try that for next week. And also Kelly Wand.
Podcasting's a likely job for the untalented.
So I'll count it off. One, two, three, go. I got a man who makes me walk here. I got a man who makes me walk here.
New and better realities and improved conditions.
Not cool.